These are the sounds of my London neighborhood, Peckham. Bus traffic, people going in and out of shops, street preachers, and music playing out on speakers, especially when the sun's out, like today. As we make our way about our lives, there are sounds we choose to listen to and sounds that just happen, whether we like them or not.
And then sometimes when you're in London and you get that heavy screeching of a siren, we're all jumping on the pavement, jumping out the way because here they come. Almost breaks your eardrums sometimes.
Distant aircrafts, somehow I associate them with summer travel. I'm on the seaside, there's boats in the distance.
Downstairs neighbors, everyone knows their kids because they wake everyone up at 7 a.m. screaming every morning.
I love the sound of the wind in the trees and hard rain, of music from around the world drifting out of back gardens. And you know what? I like the sound of a hacked Lime bike going past when school's out. It's like childhood and freedom. Sirens, though, they freeze me up. Or the sound of when you're on the top deck of a bus and it scrapes through some low-hanging tree branches. Terrible. Could you tell me in your view, like, what is sound? What, like, can you explain sound in a nutshell?
Well, sounds are vibrations of air, right, that get perceived by different beings with their whole body.
If you wait for a quiet period, especially in the early morning, you can really hear birdsong in London. So that's really impressive how many birds there are, like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Tube is just the corrugation noise and the squeal of the tube. It's incredible that exists. The first thing I bought with my first UK salary was a bike.
Car wash is loud from here, but especially in that block there, it sounds like an ocean.
And my favorite sound is the ocean. I live by the oceans, or live near an ocean, so I'm happy with that.
The sound of blackbirds calling dusk. You know, they announce it, don't they? There's a mosque across the park from me. And I'm not even sure it happens now that COVID's finished, but it was the first time ever I heard a call to prayer. It stood out. They almost happened at the same time, the blackbirds and the call to prayer.
And what makes a sound a noise?
Noise is a perceptual construct.
That's Lisa Lavia, the director of the Noise Abatement Society.
There's sound in the environment, and then how humans react to that sound is a perceptual construct. And one of those constructs is, it's noisy, I don't like it, or it's noisy, I feel like it's harming me. So if we think of noise on a continuum as, you know, oh, it bothers me a bit, but it's not, you know, I can get over it. I understand why it's happening, it's temporary, to I no longer feel safe to function in my world. But all humans, if you will, also have similar basic needs. You know, no matter what kind of vibrant life somebody might lead, at one point they do need to sleep. And at times that they need to sleep, they do probably want it quiet.
The block of flats I grew up in had an alleged quiet time from 2 to 4 p.m. It was a rule essentially made up to enforce a children are to be seen and not heard policy, which conveniently coincided with the older residents' after lunch nap. My brother once got threatened with having the police called on him for the admittedly annoying antic of throwing pebbles at the metal garage doors at the base of our building during this sacred time. I grew up thinking this was a top-down law set by the housing association or even the government, but my parents recently shrugged off this idea. It was made up. In the city, our overlapping lives expose us to different sounds all the time, but what's noise to one person might be music to another. How do we live together in sound? I got curious about this after flipping through my local council's free quarterly magazine and finding a short interview with a noise complaints officer. He said stuff like, no 2 days are the same. He mentioned all kinds of complaints, alarms, whistling boiler flues, construction, barking dogs, children playing, but the main example was loud music. And since COVID, noise complaints across London have gone up by 40%. I wondered what was going on.
The sound of the bass playing through loud music where it's so loud that it distorts. I really hate that because you can't escape it.
When people come to our helpline, when they contact us, they're at that desperation stage.
What feeds into a noise complaint?
Sometimes noise complaints can be a proxy for something else that's happening.
And what meanings does noise carry?
People are delighted. It's great. You don't really want to be going up and being like,
should some types of noise be protected?
Culture wouldn't be the same if there weren't loud music. Democracy would be different, in a way, right?
Once those drums start, and you get a full band, and we've got a good sound system, it's noisy. The whole building can be shaking. And then you've got police cars, sirens. It's like noise capital here. So to build flats, be crazy, wouldn't it?
This message is for you! Don't move to London if you don't like noise. Don't move to London if you don't like noise!
Well, I just test the sound levels. Mm-hmm. Could you describe the space, the sounds we're in, the soundscape that we're in?
good question. So, I mean, listening to it, we could be in inside a car park or inside a the bowels of a ship, maybe. But it's just the air ventilation of an enclosed space. I'm John Levac-Drever. If I was to define my thing, I would call myself an acoustic ecologist, which is a slightly archaic, kind of unfashionable term. But I still stick to it, and it's something to do with the quality of the sonic environment that we live in, and basically trying to, well, analysing it and trying to make it better for everyone and everything, if that's possible, you know, beyond humans.
John's interdisciplinary career has spanned music, acoustics consulting, sonic research, and teaching on the Goldsmiths University Sound Arts Program. Most recently, he's been developing the concept of oral diversity, proving how variable our hearing sense is. A few years ago, he produced an audio documentary on Murray Schafer, the pioneer of the concept of a soundscape. I read Schafer's well-known and rather beautiful book, The Tuner of the World, in the quiet of one of the COVID lockdowns.
For Schafer, the soundscape should be something that's quite kind of rich and diverse, which again could be quite a kind of way of ecological way of thinking, you know, not looking at one species, but multiple species all kind of living together. And he affirms that, you know, we live in the soundscape, but we're all participants of the soundscape. He uses a kind of music metaphor. You know, we are all the composers, performers, and audience of the soundscape. Now, that often doesn't feel the, you know, walking through London, that doesn't feel the case. But he's kind of giving us agency, because we're all sound makers, of course, but often we don't feel we have any kind of control over our soundscape. But very early on, Schafer is saying we do. We have power, and we have responsibility with the soundscape. So that's really
Schafer's ideas back in the 60s launched a new way of thinking about sound and noise in our shared world. It made our soundscape something that we should be aware of and concerned with.
As a soundscape person, I must say that we measure physical and objective properties of sound, but we also measure subjective properties of sound.
That's Tin Oberman. He's a research fellow at the Bartlett at UCL. His research group explores the differences in our perception of sound.
The first bit was about the definition. So, like, a number of researchers from around the world agreeing that when they talk about soundscape, they talk about the way that acoustic environments are perceived by people in context, meaning that they acknowledge that the soundscape is a perceptual construct, that there is something that's objectively measured, which is the acoustic environment, which doesn't equal soundscape, because if there's no people to perceive the acoustic environment, it's not soundscape. It's like from the days of very early noise mapping that they came up with the idea of A-weighting, kind of apply the inverse curve on the measurement, so the measurements would better reflect what people are hearing, which in building physics, it can get really crazy that you do a noise survey and you measure like 60 or 70 dB with your sound level meter and nobody hears that because it's some rumble in the building based by either the traffic or power station or something like that.
So measuring decibels just on their own doesn't reflect how we may be actually perceiving a sound. Here's Lisa again from the Noise Abatement Society.
Also, there's other external factors that come in. You know, medication can make us more sensitive to certain types of sound, certain characteristics of sound, life circumstances. You know, we haven't had a good night's sleep, or we've had another stressful, you know, loved one has passed, or, you know, our child is sick, you know, other things that put emotional stressors on us. Our sound sense is very, very nuanced.
When my son was a baby, we discovered high-speed hand dryers for the first time, and I was always the one changing his nappy in public places and trying to change him in impossible situations in a designated nappy changing area with two high-speed hand dryers on either side in continuous use. Extremely high sound levels, and of course he was always terrified, and I couldn't believe we had let this happen. I just couldn't understand why the most sensitive of spaces we'd allow this noise device into the space. Deep at the heart of acoustics is a very, very precise model of the human ear and how it's sensitive to different frequencies. It's a model based on 18 to 23-year-olds, probably male historically, and probably white historically. It's a very particular group of young, healthy people. They also have good hearing. And so when we talk about A-weighted decibels, you're talking about this very specific group of 18 to 24-year-olds. That's the group. And so when you're dealing with a child, an infant changing their nappy, being exposed to a high-speed hand dryer, and you're talking about A-weighted decibels, it's meaningless, completely meaningless. It means nothing at all. And as I look closer into this stuff, I kind of actually started talking to more people, not just about infants, but about people. I talked a lot with autistic people, people who've got cochlear implants, who've got particular hearing sensitivities, people who are partially sighted, people who are carers, or people with dementia. I mean, basically, when you start looking at it, there's a huge group of people who've got very sensitive hearing or particular hearing needs. So I've been really trying hard to communicate this about, for example, the hand dryer story. You're actually talking about accessibility.
There are layers and layers of subjectivity that go into how each of us perceive and judge our soundscape at any given time, influenced by so many factors, from our mood or stress level, to neurodivergence or health conditions, from personal preference informed by our cultures and our class background, to habituation, meaning what we've gotten used to.
I remember as a teenager, if you sit still in my bedroom, in my childhood bedroom, and don't move, even if you don't breathe, you actually can't hear anything. All you can hear is the blood rushing through your head and your ears. It's genuinely like being in an anechoic chamber. And I've taken a sound meter there and confirmed it. It is seriously quiet there. Whereas my cousin grew up in Bristol, and we used to stay with him at night, and he wouldn't notice that there was road noise, wouldn't notice that there were sirens.
James is an acoustics consultant. My exploration of noise took me to Barnes.
Just tell me what we're doing today. What are we working with here?
So I'm just setting up a standard 24-hour noise survey,
where I watched him install a decibel meter in a residential garden.
So this looks like a mic. This is the mic.
Yeah, so there's a mic capsule with a small weather shield.
The plan was to leave it there for 24 hours to get a reading of the average noisiness of the space.
Light wind up to 18 meters.
James's company has been hired to do this assessment so that a heat pump can be installed as part of some development work on the house.
And I've got to mount it 2 meters above ground level, and 3.5 plus meters from any reflective facades.
People just don't understand how planned this stuff is. Most people don't understand that noise is carefully planned. You know, flight paths and roads and air source heat pumps, you know, speakers in restaurants. People don't understand that it has to go to a committee with a report. It will get challenged, it will get scrutinized. You know, they'll have to install it with certain mitigation. Noise has a huge impact on people's health, and beyond that, actually on their well-being. There are thresholds of noise that the WHO, World Health Organization, they've conducted studies which show certain levels of noise will disrupt people's sleep, impact memory, and have a whole plethora of health conditions such as heart conditions, which can be caused by excessive noise. Mental health conditions.
Noise is a biological and psychological stressor. We can shut our eyes, we can turn away. You cannot turn off the sound sense. The way the human body processes sound is what we call psychobiologically. So the body will sense or feel the sound waves just physically for all sound, but also inaudible sound. So just like if we're touching a hot stove, you know, we feel it get it warmer, and then at one point, you know, it's too hot and we have to take our hand away. So our sound sense is always evaluating through our brain a sense of safety related to sound, and that's associated with our memory and our attachment and the context in which we evaluated that sound the last time we heard it. Or if it's the first time, then that becomes the baseline for how we then evaluate that sound going forward. And that gets embedded in the brain because the brain is trying to be efficient. So we don't have to think about it every time we hear it. It just takes the file. Oh, that's this. You know, the challenge with that is if our association with the sound is I'm annoyed, then the next time it happens, it's like they're doing it again. And then that builds up until that association is changed, or if that association is changed. But because these associations in the brain happen at a subconscious level, oftentimes we don't fully understand even why something is so annoying to us in terms of sound.
The Noise Abatement Society is a charity whose remit is to solve noise pollution problems for the public benefit. Laws and actions around noise were developed to regulate our soundscape in light of the power the sounds around us can wield on our lives.
In 1959, our founder, a gentleman named John Connell, he was concerned, as many were. There was rising concern during that period, which would have aligned with mass industrialization. Lots of new types of noise sources coming into the urban environment and all environments at that time with, you know, heavy machinery and increase in manufacturing and traffic noise source problems. And he wrote a letter to the newspaper he wrote the letter to was the Daily Telegraph, saying, you know, something must be done. And he had, as the story goes, you know, sackfuls of post delivered to him saying, absolutely, we're in. And so they lobbied the Noise Abatement Act through UK Parliament in 1960. And that was the UK's first primary noise legislation. And it set the framework for noise legislation that has followed since.
Noise was therefore legally deemed a statutory nuisance, something that every local authority has the responsibility to judge and investigate in their area. The Act launched the mechanism of the noise complaint, in which anyone can ring up the council to say, hey, this sound is bothering me, please make it stop. Of course, it's not as simple as that. A council officer has to go out and investigate the complaint, find the source of the noise. Then they have to decide if the noise constitutes a nuisance, and there's a big range of considerations that can go into that. They have to decide if the sound reported, quote, unreasonably interferes with the enjoyment of a property or is harmful to health. But as we've heard, a noise to one person may not be to another.
Some communities want or are very happy with, let's say, a very intensely vibrant area. And, you know, what might seem very noisy to other communities might be really welcomed and embraced by different communities and communities of interest. You know, whether there's vibrant nightlife or vibrant creative culture, they will be making a decision in relation to noise based on what would be deemed as appropriate for that community at that time. So what looks appropriate to one group of people in a particular community at one time can vary widely to another community.
People complain about all types of noise: traffic and road noise, construction, neighbors DIY, rattling air conditioners. These all feel relatively straightforward in the sense that it's less likely that there's someone on the other side of the noise maker, who is actually really enjoying it. It feels like it's easier to agree on the nuisance of it all, the disruption to the soundscape. But what about loud music, particularly from places that exist to play it?
If you're in the centre of Hackney or you're in the centre of the West End and you're sat there expecting things to be quiet, then that's a false economy. If you're in the middle of Soho and you want things to be quiet and you don't want people to be drinking outside during the summer, then it's a false economy. I'm Mike Gill. I'm the chief executive for something called the Nighttime Industries Association, set up since 2015, just under 10,000 members, which range from casinos all the way through to live music venues, to pubs, bars, restaurants, promoters, etc. The reality is it's about 30 to 40% more expensive to operate within the UK since 2020. I think we've worked out that we are losing a nighttime economy space one every single day since the start of this year. I think all of it at the moment just feels quite oppressive, and it doesn't feel like we're able to run the sector which is supposed to promote fun, social economy and culture. It feels like that burden of regulatory framework, safety, transport concerns and financial concerns have kind of drained some of the life out of some of the really important operators within the UK.
I asked Michael what role noise complaints play in the current trend.
It has a huge part to play, particularly in cities. I think a lot of the residents are getting a lot smarter in their approach. They're understanding the levers and instruments to which they can pull and their power within the current structure. There are, without a doubt, some very vexatious resident associations which are not interested in anything other than quiet or whitewashing or sanitization or however we want to place it. When you got to the end of COVID, we knew there was going to be an uptick in terms of noise, ambient noise alone. But what happened was the regulatory sort of frameworks of licensing, the planning, EHO, etc., were quite inconsiderate in terms of acknowledging that there was going to be a rebalance. We lack the protections that we would like to see moving forward, particularly as residential spaces become a priority for many local authorities. And I think we need to regain that sort of value or position in terms of culture and social economy, because I think there needs to be a balance proportionately.
If complaints are repeatedly made against the same venue and the council determines there to be a noise nuisance, they serve a noise abatement notice, basically a cease and desist. The venue has to adjust to reduce the noise. If the complaints continue, the police or even local residents can apply for a license review. The licensing committee can impose stricter conditions on the venue if they are to continue operating. Things like hiring security staff, closing the smoking area at a certain hour, soundproofing, and an earlier closing time. An investigation by the Londoner identified some 122 pubs in London that found themselves before a licensing committee due to neighbour complaints in 2024. So tensions mount when you have flats and housing next to pubs, clubs and music venues, which is a lot of the time in a city like London. Neighbours plus sound makers equals potential conflict. The way the system is currently set up means new neighbours may represent a direct threat to sound-making cultural spaces.
My name's Pauline Forster, and I'm the owner of the George Tavern, and I'm an artist. I came to London 23 years ago. I found this place in an auction catalogue. It was a closed-down pub. It was being sold for housing for developers. So everybody else who was looking was thinking, how many flats? I was thinking, this is a cool space to live and music. I talked with the agent outside and I said, look, I'm really serious about this place.
Pauline originally bought the building of the George Tavern in Stepney to live and make art in, but she ended up deciding to open it up as a pub again and as a now revered music and performance venue.
One day I opened the mail and it was a planning application to knock that down and build flats just there, right behind the bar. I thought, oh my God, can't have that. I rang up the council straight away. Spoke to the planning officer who was dealing with it, and I said, look, I'm going to be really seriously objecting to this because it will affect this music license and I can't have flats that close. The council immediately said, I'm sorry, but they're going to get this. I said, what? We haven't even been through a planning process yet. How can you say that? And they said, well, it is going to happen. That was the planning officer. I said, OK, well, we'll see about that. I went to see the plans. They were terrible. They were great big, higher than the George, massive. Long term, they were going to build on all the green spaces. It was like bright blue plastic panels, not in keeping with the style of the George. It would have been disgusting, if you can imagine this great big thing sticking up. Not long before I'd had Amy Winehouse here, when I came back from the council, I gave her a ring and I said, could you help me? She said, oh, get a T-shirt made with Save the George on it.
So Pauline launched the campaign with Save the George Tavern T-shirts, black lettering on a white tee. She got celebrities and public figures in the shirt to raise awareness and support for her pub.
I know that people have rights. If you live next to a place and they're making a racket every night, the people who lived in the flats would have the right to complain, and the council have to take it up. They can't say, well, you shouldn't have moved there, it was the pub. If there's no protection in place, then they have to take your licence away.
Pauline's campaign against residential development on one side of the George was eventually successful, but not long after, she faced another residential development proposal for the empty building on the other side, right next to the beer garden.
I was horrified to see that they'd actually marketed it, because I went onto the websites of the agents, and it was marketed as almost like a foregone conclusion, a site for development, residential development. So that is actually totally out of order. They shouldn't have done that, because it's like a promise. It's like, if you buy this, you'll get planning permission for flats. I had a battle on my hands, because it was a private developer who bought it. They came to see me pretty quickly, and they tried to be, he brought me his business card, and it was a Lego brick with it printed on there. He was trying to make out that I'm so sympathetic with art and I love art and culture and I don't want to, but that's, you know, I know all those lines. They all say that. Oh, we want to work, we love the George, we appreciate it. We, you know, it's two-faced, barefaced lying.
The Ministry of Sound, an iconic nightclub in Elphinstone, won an important legal battle in 2014, applying the concept of a deed of easement to an existing venue's ability to make noise. A deed of easement is a legal agreement that protects the right to use land for a specific purpose. In the case of the Ministry of Sound, they got their noisemaking legally enshrined into the local soundscape in the context of a nearby proposed residential tower block. Basically, we make noise, and we've always made noise, and it's on you to deal with it. Pauline sought to make the same novel argument for the George Tavern, and she won it, becoming maybe the second venue in the UK to get this kind of agreement.
It was a condition of the planning application being granted that in the deeds they had to have a clause saying nobody could ever complain about the noise from the George 24/7 for the rest of eternity while this place exists and is open as a live music venue or any kind of venue or pub. I've had to be like that all my life. You know, I've worked hard. Harder than most people can imagine. I've been homeless. I've made my way from nothing. I brought up five kids myself. You know, I can stand up to anybody. I've had it. That just makes me even more determined.
There's a more recent principle compared to a deed of easement that can be used to protect venues from developments that may threaten them with noise complaints in the future. It's called agent of change, and it means that the new arrival, the agent of change, has the responsibility to absorb the impact of any problems. Here's James, the acoustics consultant.
In that situation, we've got an existing venue, which is all licensed and all, you know, it's clearly pre-existing, and a new development. So the new developer is the agent of change. Therefore, it should be the new developer's responsibility to assess the level of environmental noise there, specifically emanating from that club, with surveys when it's in operation. I mean, yeah, I've seen some blocks built across the road from a nightclub before, and it was enforced on them as a planning condition. They had triple glazing on the living areas and quadruple glazing on the bedrooms. I doubt you could even hear, like, a nuclear blast through that. Like, that is beyond recording studio levels of soundproofing. That is, like, truly inaudible. You know, the reality of life is a lot of those residents in there had then found ways to open those windows because they weren't meant to be open. So obviously they weren't providing them adequate ventilation. When the policy works well, it can work really well. When it's, you know, viewed from all aspects, you know, they've got air conditioning and it's blocking the sound out effectively. But you have to allow for the fact the real world doesn't always work like the plans intend.
They were sent through to someone on the team, weren't they? They were like, have you seen this?
Moth Club in Hackney is another venue fighting a development next door.
I'm Lorenzo Martinotti.
I'm Felix Cristofori. Me and Lorenzo are both the duty managers here at the Moth, and we are responsible for the sort of day-to-day operations and all of the paperwork that goes into making noise happen, yeah. Which is a surprisingly large amount.
Yeah.
We are, I suppose, a mixed event space. We have everything from screenings to club nights to gigs. Occasionally we have talks, not very often, but...
Comedy nights.
It's quite eclectic, really. So there's a real variety of things that can be happening each day to day. Next to where the Moth Club is currently a series of units that are shops right now. So there's a Mexican place, there's a nail salon, and I can't remember what the other one is. I think it's a fruit shop. The proposal would demolish them and put a classic tagline, luxury flats, up. The direct issue that causes for us is that in the way that it's laid out currently, the balconies of some of those flats would be directly above our smoking area. Sort of backing onto, you know, the top of the hall where most of the base bins are. So anyone that lives there is going to not become our biggest fans very quickly. I personally wouldn't want to be living directly above a smoking area where people are like being noisy and loud until 3 a.m. The initial proposal, I think that they did a sort of classic bit of jiggery pokery where they swapped it from one unit which would have had separate concerns around planning to two, and I think that lowers your burden on having to do accessible housing or, at least affordable housing.
To clarify what Felix mentioned there, Hackney Council has the requirement for developers to provide a rate of 50% affordable housing if a residential proposal is for 10 or more flats. The development next to Moth Club is for 12 flats, but they made two separate applications for 6 flats each, meaning they can avoid the requirement.
The government aren't. I mean, it's getting better, but it's taken a long time, and still they're on the side of the developers. And now they've got the card that, oh, well, we need housing. Yeah, we do need housing, but we're not getting the right kind of housing anyways.
Pauline told me about the developer behind one of the proposals she battled against.
They got given their housing estate by the council for a penny. They're supposed to kind of like do their estate up and make it good and everything. Instead of the council running it, they do it. What they do is they run down the estate, they build on all the green spaces, private flats, they pay themselves loads of money. They don't do any work on the properties, and then they try and get rid of people and run them down, so then they have to knock them down and then they can build all their great big... They use the George as a selling point, with pictures of Kate Moss here, you know, celebrities and stuff like that. This amazing George Tavern with all its culture. So it's pretty shocking.
An area is predominantly a working class area, and then when a wave of migration happens, that's where people move to. And then you end up with that being the most affordable parts of town. And then that's when the people who have no money but want to create move in. You then have the people who have the money to go anywhere they want being like, ah, yeah, that's the greatest spot, I'm going to go there. It's an unfortunate one because if these flats were built, it wouldn't be an immediate death sentence. It would be a sort of like a sword above the head for a really long time because, say, it's filled exclusively with people who are like, love Hackney, love nightlife, love music, I'm here to stomach the noise. They've still bought a flat, and the sort of thing you do when you've bought a house is then maybe have a kid or you have other responsibilities and your priorities change.
The Moth Club have launched a public petition to Hackney Council objecting to the proposed development next door. I asked them about the current noise complaints.
Deliveries coming in and out, clang, crash, like moving all the barrels around. Trash recycling, crowds of people standing outside. Sometimes people are having a really good night and they love to scream. And there's only so much you can do after someone's already started screaming.
After the first scream, you try to stop the second and third. That's what we're trying to do.
Stopping the screams.
Yeah, yeah.
No one wants residents to not sleep, but no one obviously doesn't want to do business and not have a social or cultural economy, because it's really important to the UK as a whole. The way that we see things and the way nighttime economy is perceived is burdensome. And I think what tends to happen is it's been portrayed as a bit of an onerous resource drain, particularly late night economy. And where you talk about alcohol and that side of things, it becomes an issue. But it starts with us being valued as an industry, bearing in mind that we're bigger than beauty, bigger than fashion, bigger than automotive as a total revenue driver. I think what we always see, we devalue it with the negative connotations around it, where I think it has a positive interest, particularly for physical, social and mental well-being. Communities thrive from it because it shapes communities, but it also supports communities economically.
It's interesting to note, though, that real estate and development generates more revenue than music and culture. Here's Pauline talking about one of the developers again.
They went bankrupt when they've been given millions, taxpayers' money, going to support all their kind of stupid deals. They stole 50 million off the government at one point, which I found out about through freedom of information, falsifying papers about developments that never happened. So they had to pay that back, but they didn't get any fines. They didn't get shamed. There was like a bit in the newspaper that you had to have, know about it and have a microscope if you wanted to catch it. It was like they were getting away with blue murder. And even then, with all that money, and we have to do everything on our own, it's really not fair. Everything costs a lot of money. We've got council tax has gone up from 5.5 to 16,900. So I have to pay for my own rubbish to be collected. You've got to pay for the music licence. That's, I don't know, so many thousand a year. To have that music, we have to have two security guards outside. They're really expensive. You've got to pay your sound engineers, equipment. Things get broken all the time. And it's hard with everybody on the lowest wage, London living wage, and cleaners every day. Electricity went up to 36 grand a year. It's like a Titanic of machinery kind of whirring around, and it's the meters going boom, 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 boom. The UK has benefited as a country from music going out into the world. We're kind of like up there with the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Amy Winehouse, all those people that make Great Britain great. And yet we're not supporting the grassroots. You know, people start here, it's their first stage. It's where every band needs to get their fan base, their practice, you know. We're so important.
Yeah, there's like a pipeline of different venue sizes that people play on their way to the O2. It's vital to not just have those huge places that are so far out that they've, are isolated from noise as an issue with the neighbourhood, because it means that you're effectively sort of strangling the pipeline on future artists having places to grow up and develop and get exposed to people that might potentially be able to push their career further. Ever since COVID, the number of nightlife venues in the UK has gone down by a third, from about 1,200 to about 800, which is the biggest drop-off in UK history. It would truly be a shame to lose these spaces where, people of all ages, but especially younger people who might not be able to develop a sort of taste for coming to gigs and having a place to just go out late and have fun with their friends.
It was interesting to talk to Pauline, Felix and Lorenzo about the very real threat of future noise complaints. It highlighted how developers can get away with unfit residential projects in a context where cultural spaces and venues are not being valued or officially protected. The fact that venues have to be ready to fight and campaign on the issue highlights just how easily a slew of noise complaints can threaten a music license. It also speaks to how our current system of managing noise nuisance creates a battleground between some residents, neighbors, and sources of loud music. I reached out to Emma Warren, a writer who's been documenting music and culture for decades. I recently read her book, Dance Your Way Home, which explores the history of dancing and dance floors in the UK context. She sent me some voice notes of her thoughts.
It just makes me think, who are the licensing committees answering to. Is this about votes and council elections? In which case, who do they think is voting for them? How does loudness and noise and celebration become a vote winner as opposed to a vote loser? I think that the balance between expression and regulation is way off in this country. But that's also because it's in this country. And I think we have a globally anomalous relationship to communal sound in the sense that in other countries, if your neighbour's playing loud music, maybe you might just go and join the party. Whereas here, if your neighbour's playing loud music, there is a tendency within some quarters of our society to complain and to get someone else, not even you, to go and get it turned off. Some of this is to do with issues of control. It's to do with who has agency in this country. It's also to do with cities and countryside and people's ideas about what happens in each of them. This kind of idea that people have a right to silence in the city is just beyond my comprehension. But it's definitely there. And I think that's to do also with class and power. Who has the right to shut down sound? Who has the right to squash collective joy? Who needs collective joy? Who doesn't? And whether or not the economic cushioning, the wealth divide that we have in this country and the massive power divide we have in this country also is part of the answer. There's a difference between when you're asked to quiet down and when you are made to quiet down. I think a lot is lost, so much is lost on an individual and collective level when we're asked to be quiet. And actually it's very infantilising. Your question makes me think of a child. Hush now.
We're all affected by sound and we can all easily be the noisemaker ourselves. So how do we need these collaborative solutions where people can, you know, get along and get something that's going to work for them and their environment. These solutions are generative, much more like a biodiversity type approach to how sound is managed in local communities as opposed to this punitive, you know, pesticide, put it out, stop it.
How can we find solutions to disagreements about something as subjective as sound and noise?
Well, I'm Alan Sharland. I've been a mediator since 1994, so 30, coming up to 31 years now. For me, conflict is, it's an inevitability. It's a thing that happens everywhere. It gets a bad press because of how people respond to conflict. It's an inevitable part of life arising from difference is how I would want to speak of it. And that difference could be anything. You know, I think you should park your car there because I don't want it to be parked where it is, kind of thing. Or I think you should play your music lower, even though you might want to play it louder because it's dance music or something, you know, whatever my reasoning. You know, I want you to be different. You don't want to be different. I try to make you different. You don't like it. So I then call you stubborn. You call me oppressive and it blows up. I don't talk about conflicts as a bad thing. I talk about conflicts as inevitable. And I would say generally, you know, most of our organizational systems, when any kind of complaint or difficulty arises, it's an adversarial process which is followed. You're wrong and I'm right, and here's the evidence that you're wrong. On the 21st of September last year, you played music till 2 o'clock in the morning. There's one piece of evidence. And then it's presented to someone to say, oh, what a bad person Sophia is, you know. So she's wrong, I'm right, so I'm triumphant, and, you know, you're a bad person, etc. And while that sounds quite simple, it's often very difficult to come to that clarity of outcome. But nevertheless, the feeling between you and me through that process is getting worse and worse and worse. One side is expected to bring all the evidence against the other side, and it's built into some of our systems.
The word that came to mind when talking to Alan about our current mechanisms of dealing with conflict was inflammatory. People on each side of an argument getting stuck in their positions in ways that make it impossible to see eye to eye. Here's Michael from the Nighttime Industries Association again.
The challenge that we have is we need to gain a balance. And I don't think anyone wants anything other than balance, but I think that comes with dialogue and collaboration. It doesn't come with vexatious sort of dialogue breakdown. And I think the arbiters of that are not exactly built for recognizing both sides of the fence. I think what we've got to do is get to a point where there is a conversation.
And here's Lisa.
It's about everybody coming together and saying, well, how do we fit this puzzle together in a way that can work for us as a community? So this is a creative design problem. It's not a we can't get along problem, right? It's like, how can we, just to use a very simple analogy, move the furniture around in this space so that we can all sit in the room together? You know, it's like if you, again, if you were rearranging everybody, you know, you have a sitting room. You think, okay, well, you have these common pieces of furniture that we all want in our sitting room, but we all might want them in different places because we do different things at different times. And so how can we create a space that we can actually all use? Ultimately, communities want to get along.
Lisa told me about a situation the Noise Abatement Society was commissioned to help with on West Street, Party Central in Brighton.
We talked to the clubs, we talked to, you know, the club owners, people who worked at the clubs, the bouncers, the police, the highways authority. I mean, all aspects of the council, local councillors, community groups, to get everyone's view of what was happening. The assumption was people are complaining about the noise because they want the noise to stop. And then the businesses, the club owners, the restaurant owners, the hotels that are in the area, all of that were saying, it's been a clubbing district forever. Why are people living here if they don't like the noise?
Don't move to London if you don't like noise!
And so there was this complete standoff. Once we started to unpick this with the community groups and with all the opposing groups, immediately, really almost instantly, everybody said to us, right, what can we do? You know, what are our options? Once everybody understood everyone's points of view, nobody wanted a punitive solution. Everybody wanted to find a way to make it work.
And it feels like we should and need to find a way to make it work. Because maybe that's what being a community really means. Accepting the fact that conflicts are inevitable, especially when we're all bumping up against each other in the urban sprawl. Accepting the fact that we may all get bothered by sound for different reasons, and that this will just happen more often in a city. And accepting and protecting the fact that we need places to gather and express ourselves and be together. It also sounds like we need to keep those developers in check.
It is an open door that is really important. There's conversation going on. People meet one another. Most of what we're talking about now since lockdown is this loneliness, mental health, which was never discussed before, but it is now more and more. But people need people. And I felt that in the past, with all these developments going on, they were shutting these places down, regardless. And, you know, people were being forced indoors with supermarket alcohol, a big screen. It's a recipe for disaster, basically.
I think communal music is an ancient human need and an ancient human right. You know, people talk about the right to roam. What about the right to hear amplified music together or to hear music together? I'm sure there would have been complainers about people with their drums, banging their drums, you know, hundreds of years ago. But nobody would have taken any notice of them because it would have been a nonsense to try and suggest that it wasn't normal and a need to have those moments, you know, at least every 6 weeks, which actually matches the kind of cycle of either pagan moments or sort of like working class moments. So you'd have, you know, your solstices and then your autumn, your other equinoxes, and then your quarter festivals. And when you put those into place, you've suddenly got a big party every 6 weeks, which I think is the minimum.
What if we're not all out to get each other? What if we're just needing to learn how to better connect?
Sound, particularly low-end sound, allows me to drop into a non-thinking state and into a feeling state really quickly. And that's very important for me because it's hard for me to do that in any other situations. I think a lot of people know what it's like to feel very adrenalized or cortisolized or overthinking-y. And loud music, bassline music, somehow offers an opportunity to enter a different thinking, feeling space accessed through the body, not the mind. Musicians, when they're playing in synchrony, share biochemical states, and I think the same thing probably happens to us when we're dancing as well. That things like our blood pressure, our vital signs, start moving together, start working together. So sharing the sound in these collective moments allows for more bonding, more togetherness on a kind of potentially biochemical sort of level.
It's impossible for the human brain to turn off the sound of other people's voices.
Lisa mentioned something in passing that I found really interesting.
We're biologically and psychologically wired to connect. We cannot just ignore human voices. So magnify that in an environment where somebody's maybe asleep or about to go to sleep, and there's very, very loud human voices outside.
We're social creatures. We hear people talking, we hear voices, and our brains are wired to latch onto it. So in this funny sort of way, being kept awake by the mumbling of voices through our walls is proof of our human condition. Noise Capital was produced by me. Music and sound design by the brilliant Jake Thomas. Gabby O'Donnell provided invaluable mentorship during the whole process. I'd like to thank my generous contributors, Michael Kill, Tin Oberman, Lisa Lavia, John Levac-Driever, Felix Cristoforo and Lorenzo Martinotti at Moth Club, Pauline Forster at the George Tavern, James Lansdowne, Alan Sharland, Felix Loftus, and Emma Warren for lending their insights and their voices. Very special thanks to Attar Ahmad, James Bull, and Lawrence Avis at UCL, Julia Kobach, Carlotta Adams, Johan de Ricard, and Fabrice Robinson. Also to Serena Mirambo-Bray, Rosemary Moss, Jasper Appleby for their support. This project was produced on the Audio Storytelling Program at the University College London Public Anthropology Department.